We're talking about the big, flat, sandy areas that most people think of as having lots of pine trees on them. These are all outwash plains formed during the waning periods of glaciation. The biggest ones run from about Bagley to the east side of Winnie. That's the Bemidji Sand Plain. Then there's the Park Rapids Sand Plain. Park Rapids is about in the middle of that particular sand plain. And that's called the Park Rapids Sand Plain, as you might guess. And there's also a big sand plain at Staples as you go to south and into Wadena County. And there's one just south of Brainerd called the Pillager Sand Plain.
Oh, my.
And then going to the northeast from Brainerd is the Crow Wing Sand Plain. And all of these have a similar history.
Okay.
The timing is quite different. So we're probably going to have to back up to where we have ice on the land and glaciation. That's where we tend to start mostly with the history of vegetation or anything on the surface of Minnesota. And during the waning stages of ice, probably mostly between around 11 to 9,000 years ago, the landscape was settling. The glaciers were no longer moving, but we had these massive pieces of ice sitting on our land and buried in our land. And it took quite some time for that stuff to melt out. And the whole new landscape was evolving. So it's important that people know that these pine lands are in the topographic lows of the region. They're traversed by major rivers, especially the Mississippi River, but also the Crow Wing River, and a variety of tributaries to those rivers. These places sit on topographic lows. There are mountains of ice, you know, on the moraines that surround them. And water still goes downhill.
Yeah. I'm glad they haven't changed that.
Yeah.
It would really make it difficult.
Still goes downhill. And of course, it was laden with sediment. As the ice, there tended to be water up against the ice because of the weight of the ice is enough to depress the crust of the earth. And we had water along the face of the ice, and sooner or later, as meltwater contributed to that, it had to go somewhere. It entrained lots and lots of sediment and formed these great big sand plains.
Now, this wouldn't be a lake bottom. This isn't like Glacial Lake Agassiz. This isn't sediment.
No.
This is outwash. This is water-moving soil.
It's sediment because rivers are carrying it.
Okay.
But the difference is that it's very, it ultimately is so laden with sediment, it can clog its own channel.
Ah.
And it probably looked very much like the so-called braided streams in Alaska and other places where we still have active glaciers. So, you know, you would get the seasonal bursts of water, enough energy in the water to carry sand. Then as winter comes, the flow, obviously, of meltwater decreases. And it can sort of clog up and just keeps winding back and forth in these topographic lows, leaving ultimately a fairly flat surface, although it will reflect the gradient in the river. So,
but none of these rivers that you mentioned, the Crow Wing and maybe the Strait and some of those, they're not fast-flowing rivers that are dropping over ledges and so forth. They're kind of, they're sort of a meandering through a very slow gradient.
Well, it's a flat landscape.
Yeah.
And when it's flat, rivers meander. So that's how these places basically got formed. And had we been around when the ice was finally gone, it would have looked almost exactly like it does today.
Seriously?
Really. Yeah. The vegetation of these places was mostly red and jack pine forest. But these are very young soils at the time. Hardly anything in them. Poor soils. Pine trees do fine on poor soils, and most of the vegetational record that we see that's about 9 to 8,000 years old when we take cores out of these lakes.
I don't want to back up too much, but explain how you know this. How do you know that it was jack pine and red pine?
Yeah, I spent the better part of my graduate career taking core samples of sediment out of lakes. And basically, it's a stratigraphically intact geologic deposit, meaning that young deposits are on top and the old ones are down low. And we can radiocarbon date the organic matter in that and come up with a history. And the history that I put together was based on what I saw in the way of fossil pollen grains.
Pollen?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very resistant to decay, particularly in a wet, mostly anaerobic environment in the bottom of a lake. and stuff is very well preserved. So we look at those, we look at some microfossils, and my brother, the hydrologist, did a very similar study out on Parker's Prairie. Oh. There's a big sand plain out in Parker's Prairie, where he studied the paleo changes in lake levels. He got more into the water balance and understanding water is a better way to get at climate change than just inferring it from vegetation. Because a lot of the plants that make lots of pollen, like an aspen tree, it could be grown in Alaska, or it could be grown in Mexico, or it could be growing in Minnesota. So they aren't very climate-specific organisms to look at. But water balance is a good thing. So my brother and I spent lots of time going around to these places trying to come up with lake sediments. And the biggest disappointment for me, I eventually found some, but these sand plains, you got out on these sand plains and there was no sediment. And you're going, what the heck? We just pulled 14 meters out of Lake Irvin here in Itasca County. And we get on these sand plains, especially around Bemidji and Park Rapids, and we couldn't find any sediment in them.
Wow.
So that's part of the story. 8,000 years ago, it was very warm. It was warmer than our climate now, and apparently very much drier. And the only conclusion you can arrive at is that the water tables had dropped so much due to these mid-Holocene droughts, 6,000 years ago, that there was no lake mud. There was nothing to look at.
There were no lakes. If you were walking that area, you'd be walking on sand and...
Yeah, they just weren't lakes.
Okay.
And probably lots and lots of the tributaries to these rivers that drained these outwash plains were just intermittent, or maybe even the Mississippi itself.
Wow.
Didn't really flow at peak aridity during those periods
okay.
of time. So we knew that it was very dry. And we've cored lakes that are now as deep as 30 feet. Leidic Lake along Mississippi River between Cass and Winnie
is
an example of that. That's dune sand underneath. And the sediments are only 4,000 years old, which to a geologist is nothing. But we learned that an awful lot of the surface water features of these sand plains didn't exist during that period of time. In fact, what also didn't exist were trees. There were no trees. It was treeless for the most part. Maybe some aspen thickets and oak, stunted oaks and stuff like that. But for the most part, these sand plains are prairies. And the fascinating thing about prairies is what they do to make soil, because they're dominated by grasses and not trees. And what grasses do that trees don't is that they tend to abandon their root systems in place about every 2-3 years. So they're constantly growing new roots. One's gone in search of nutrients and couldn't support itself and dies. And these roots penetrate to, 4, 5, 6 feet deep, because they're very they're in a droughty environment, and they penetrate deeply, and it builds organic matter in soil, which has everything to do with the soil fertility, because the sands themselves don't hold much in the way of nutrients or the ions that are attracted to soil particles. They hold 10 times more water than sand can. They hold nutrients. And they are dandy for growing potatoes. If you can find those deep organic sands, these are perfect places to grow potatoes. And not only potatoes, virtually all the nursery stock that forestry uses comes from places exactly like this.
We're speaking with John Allmendinger. He's a forest ecologist. And you're listening to this discussion on 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, Hibbing, Virginia, Big Fork, and Aiken, and 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, Fauston, Clearbrook, Park Rapids, and Red Lake are at 89.9 in the Brainerd Lakes area, 103.9 in Ely, and we're talking about a big part of the central and western part of our listening area with John, trying to learn more about this place we live that we assumed always had waters and always had rivers and lakes and always had forests, and actually there was long stretches of time when that didn't exist. I want to bring Harry Hutchins on. Again, Harry, you've been listening to John with his description so far. Do you have any questions or comments to add?
John, these were mostly jack pine?
The earlier forests were primarily jack pine. It started out as pine forest after the deglaciation.
Okay.
And then it got warm and dry and was prairie. So much so that there was the sand plains were affected by wind and built dune features on the surfaces. Some of these outwash plains, particularly in high banks on Winnie and places like that. But there were no trees, and sand was blowing around, and it was prairie.
High banks on Winnie.
Yeah, there's a
period. Sand dunes.
Right. There's a soil study there by one of my old professors, and the buried organic soils, you can see the old soil surfaces buried by the sand, and that's the head of the Bena Dune Field is what we call it.
Okay.
And those dunes were active to some extent during the mid-Holocene, and they probably kept blowing to the south and altered the course of the Leech River. They kept filling in the north bank of the Leech River,
okay.
And kept shoving it farther south, and if you take a canoe up there, it's all sand on the north side and it's all till on the south side.
Wow.
So it was capturing quite a bit of the entrained sands during these windy periods.
Okay, and of course the Leech now flows out of Leech Lake, out of Federal Dam area, all the way up to the Mississippi, south of Winnie, south of Deer River and all. You looked at
does
me
now.
Like, yeah, that's what I meant, now. Okay, now, what brought this to my attention about 6 years ago was Potlatch owned thousands and thousands of acres and was a forest wood products company in Minnesota for almost a century.
Northwest Paper.
Yeah. They started reducing their wood products businesses, selling the paper mill in Cloquet, for example, would be one, and some of their board plants, and began more of a real estate company, began selling off some of their woodlands. And they sold some of the woodlands in Crow Wing and Cass to potato growers. R.D. Offutt is the big potato grower in the nation, actually, based in Fargo. So there was a lot of attention paid to the conversion of what was then Pinelands to potato growing. But I'm getting way ahead of this story because you're saying that there were these phases where...
Yes, and that is ultimately what my brother and I found in all these places was that the story was the same everywhere. It was prairie, then it was oak, and then it was pine trees.
You said mostly jack pine or red pine? How'd red pine get there? You said you found very little...
In the early stuff, we only knew of one place. We retrieved a red pine needle from the bottom of Mantrap Lake, pretty close to Park Rapids.
A red pine needle.
Otherwise, the pollen's indistinguishable between two species.
You can't tell
them apart, but the assumptions are that it was predominantly jack pine. But now we got to get some trees on this landscape. So we need to start about 4,000 years ago now.
So up to this point, we've got the grasses, and they're putting organic. Now, if you dug that soil, you talked about it being organic. Would you notice anything in the soil that would say, this is organic? Like when I dig in my yard, I get, you know, I've got 6 or 8 inches of black.
Yep.
And then just sand.
Pretty much the same thing.
Okay.
It's black, but it's black quite a ways down.
Oh, all right.
So deeper than the surface.
And this is thousands of years of grasses.
Well, starting around 8,000 and until trees invaded the place. So the climate turns around, and we see this signal all over Minnesota around 4,000 years ago.
All right.
Lots of vegetation change statewide, not just here. It was becoming more mesic. And dependent on apparently
what's mesic now?
Means that it's getting sufficient water.
Oh, okay.
And nutrients. So it was getting the water and nutrients the plants like, and it was becoming more amenable to trees occurring on these sand plains. We saw the same story everywhere.
Really?
Prairie, this is like oak, aspen, brush land, and then pine trees.
Wow.
But it happened at different times in different places. So that was the real story. And what happened is that the water table started to rise once again. And when the water table rose, it made streams more permanent. You know, you might go from an intermittent stream to one that has pretty much permanent flow. Lakes started to appear on the landscape. So surface water features were once again being evident on the surfaces of these sand plains. And they're great fire breaks. The one thing that we needed, not just a little more water for the trees to grow there, was the fact that they didn't burn up every 2-3 years being in a prairie.
Okay.
So it decreased the frequency of fires, and trees started to grow there. It started as early as 3,000 years ago at a place called Lake Minnie, which is just north of Lake George.
All right.
In Bemidji, 1,500 years ago, roughly the same on the Crow Wing Outwash Plain up toward Big Pelican Lake and north of Gull Lake, or toward a little lake there. That was also around 15. Then there were places around Dorset, if people know where that little burg is, but east of Grand Rapids. Recent as
Park Rapids.
Park Rapids, I'm sorry. That was about 600 years ago.
There was that recent?
That recent. And then the only place I could find sediment on the Park Rapids Sand Plain near the town of Osage, which is on the western end, this place called Peterson's. I called it Peterson's Slough because the guy that owned it was named Peterson, but it's the headwaters of the Straight River, which is very much part of this conversation. And it is, has massive groundwater input and upwellings, and it forms the headwaters of the Straight River. And because it's so cool, springs, it's a trout stream.
Yeah.
And people go trout fishing in the Straight River. So the Straight River is a little different than some of these others. It was the only place I could find mud at all. And by the way, the full hole scene record was there, 10 meters worth of it.
Wow.
What I really remember were beaver chips coming up all through it.
Oh, my.
But apparently it was quite the oasis for groundwater, and but it was still prairie at that time. So these places all have different histories. Some places never did become forests. We have historic prairies. There was one north of Shell Lake, which is very close to Osage, where we were just talking about. But the Fishhook Prairie and the Hubbard Prairie, and all of these little places never did have trees, so they've been prairie for 8,000 years. Other places were in this oak, grub, aspen-y stage. In fact, you can walk in this pine forest now and still sort of see that. I mean, the understory is loaded with these oak grubs and stunted trees, and some places ultimately became pine forests. And the difference is that the pine forest litter helps to remove the organic matters from the soil. So they lose a lot of their cation exchange capacity and ability to hold nutrients. So ultimately, the surrounding topography and geologic circumstances determine which areas of these sand plains would become forest again. So there are places that are really good to grow potatoes. There are places that are really good to grow pine trees. And it's hard to know unless you're totally paying attention to the organic matter in the soil. The places that have been pine trees the longest have the least. It's been leaching, and organic matter has been coming out of the soil. It's down around 1.2, 1.3% organic matter. And then you get to places just off the Straight River around Osage where all the potato fields are. I found a couple woodlots where I could dig. I used to dig in the cemeteries and hoped I didn't hit anything down there. But that's those historic places are black dirt all the way down, and it's 6-7% in there.
Wow.
So the point is that this place is very spatially heterogeneous.
Heterogeneous means it's varied. Brought a variety to it.
Sort of like a quilt work
on the
landscape where some is good, some is bad, some has higher water tables than others. And what's also different about this place is that it's very flashy. I've dug holes with Dan Hansen for 20 years.
Dan's a soil scientist.
Yes, he is. And sometimes there's water in the hole, and sometimes it's so dry you can't keep the sand in your auger.
Wow.
You know, you try to drill, and you just keep coming up with nothing because it's just absolutely bone dry.
Wow.
So the critical part as far as the native vegetation goes is to be very drought resistant and tolerant of this kind of unpredictability. But now the issues that we're starting to face with this place is that people want to commercially use these places and have some predictability for their businesses. And the answer is it's complicated, which is always the correct answer in ecology.
It's complicated.
Or it depends.
Yeah. Okay. I'll remember. Maybe I could be an ecologist now. It's complicated.
Yeah.
It depends.
That's your answer for everything.
Yeah, and we should.
We're talking with John Nomendinger, a forest ecologist. In a moment, we'll be talking with Kirsten Bland. She's a freshwater ecologist with the Nature Conservancy, and her projects include forest and freshwater protection in the Mississippi Headwaters area. So that will involve a little discussion of the kind of predictability John was just telling us about that potato growers need. They need to control that nutrients and the water to grow potatoes there. But right now I want to bring Harry Hutchins back on the line. Harry, you've been listening to John and John go on here. Anything you want to add?
So my question is, today, if you went and cut those pine trees and, say, burn the slash, would it come up prairie plants? I mean, is that prairie seed still in the soil?
Yes. If it's native, if it's native, Harry.
And native is important because it's so drought tolerant. Is that why? That's what distinguishes something native in that area.
And that has changed. First of all, we're farming pine trees just like the farmers
like potatoes,
want to farm potatoes.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's all plantations, heavy. It requires, because some of these soils are still pretty rich, lots of competition, requires a lot of herbicides. At least the Potlatch Corporation did lots of that, and the DNR, and I think the counties do too in those regions. That's pretty much the standard recipe. Requires a lot of herbicides and stuff. And in 1982 or 81, I can't remember, I took a picture of a huge potlatch clear cut in Eccles Township by the airport in Bemidji. And it looked like the most beautiful prairie you have ever seen in your life. And I sent it to the Nature Conservancy and said, how'd you like 2,000 acres of this?
Oh, wow.
And they said, wait a second, I see a stump. So I didn't fool them. But these places are very much prairie if they're native and they've been burned and stuff. But very little of this land is native. It's an I probably got the term wrong because I'm not involved with this in the DNR anymore. But it was listed as state threatened or an endangered community. So
the plant, native, the plant community, the vegetation.
Yeah, it's infrequent between the fields and the pine plantations. You don't find much of it. Almost all of it dates to the 1976 Padura fire.
Uh-huh.
There are some fires that got away from us in the 50s before we went back and planted them, and they came back to pine trees, so why bother? Uh-huh. So we've got a few of those areas left.
What did that Padura... I remember that Padura fire.
There burned for a couple years.
Yeah, right? There was...
Pete was on fire.
There was smoke all over northern Minnesota from that fire.
Yeah, they've always... It's always been fire-prone. It's a very droughty place, and the regeneration of jack pines is phenomenal. You know, 15,000 trees an acre, which is hard. That means it's hard to not step on one.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So
now I'm going to add, jack pines, is it your favorite tree species? I think a while back you told me it was your favorite
tree. They gave me a degree for it anyway.
Well, you know, Kristen Bland has been listening in to part of this discussion this morning, and she's a freshwater ecologist and planner with the Nature Conservancy. She's based here in northern Minnesota in the Mississippi Headwaters, and her projects include forest and freshwater protection in the Mississippi Headwaters area, which, of course, includes this Pineland Sands region we're talking about. It's a big region of parts of Cass and Hubbard and Becker and Wadena County. And she's also familiar with, and John has mentioned, the Strait River watershed, which is kind of the northwest part of the Pineland Sands region. And we want to bring Kirsten into our discussion right now just to find out what she's learned about protecting the waters of the Pineland Sands region. Kirsten, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah. Well, where would you like to jump in on this discussion from your perspective of a freshwater ecologist and the waters of the Pineland Sands?
Well, I'm enjoying the discussion about the native ecosystems and how much of that feed source is still in the soils if they haven't been turned over. So, of course, it's sort of a prairie forest border ecoregion, so there were fires historically that would have come in and turned it to prairie for a while, and you had the jack pine savanna. So it's forest and native ecosystems, so we're interested in protecting the critical places where the recharge happens. And often that's, you know, in the headwater recharge areas or along the stream corridors, but in these coarse glacial soils, the recharge is kind of happening everywhere.
Yeah.
So it's important to protect a pretty large part of the landscape for ensuring that water gets filtered.
Well, as we heard John describe the First of all, the way we've cultivated not only potatoes, but trees, red pine and jack pine in this region, there's been a lot of, and also John mentioned how water of the region, it can become very dry and very wet, and it's unpredictable. So the people who are growing potatoes or trees, they want that that controlled environment with enough water and using herbicides, and in the case of potatoes, also fertilizing. And I just wonder, well, from your perspective, what are the concerns about the impact of the herbicides or the fertilizers on our waters?
I was just thinking about that as I sipped my coffee, that it works a lot like making coffee. We want that control over the water delivery, so we sometimes do both the irrigation and the drainage to be able to get the water off when there's too much, but also supply water when there's not enough. But what that the risk there is when you're filtering the water through this bare soil or not very well vegetated soil, it works just like the coffee grounds, and everything that is soluble in the water dissolves and leaches right into the groundwater. And so we tend to have high nitrate contamination in the areas that are these sand plain aquifers.
Well, you know, John also mentioned the Strait River and the Strait River watershed, and there was a study of the Strait River. Gee, I remember back in the 90s, there was concern about potato growing and its impact on the Strait River watershed. And Strait River, as John said, became a trout stream, a designated trout stream. But there's also been reports that the impact of our cultivation has warmed up that stream enough to that it's threatened that status as a trout stream. Is that your understanding?
It's complicated. Our lakes and streams in these parts of the state are groundwater fed. The groundwater, they're connected to the ground. The surface water and the groundwater is connected. And a lot of the hydrology studies up in that region, I think, got started trying to understand the links between lake levels and groundwater withdrawals. And so, you know, the main time that can happen is when you are in a period of low water and the base flows get very low. And then any additional withdrawals that affect the water level in the stream can certainly lower the minimum flows. And the less water is in the stream, the more likely it is to really overheat to the lethal temperatures that trout and other cold water species can't tolerate in the summertime.
Yeah. I don't remember a year, late summer, where our stream levels and lake levels have remained so consistently high. Is that an accurate impression of our lake and stream levels this year?
It certainly is what I'm observing around here,
seeing?
And I'm,
okay.
I've read that it's true, or seen that it's true. We actually, I'm in the north central Minnesota, Lake Alexander, Chaminade area, and the houses on Chaminade are flooding out right
Ooh.
Now because there's no natural outlet. There's the water is up around a lot of the lower lakeshore houses. It's quite a local concern
uh-huh.
moment.
Well, the reason I brought this up is that a lot of the concern about potato growing right now has to do with the growers have asked DNR for water permits to extract groundwater, and there's been concern over the years, maybe not this year because of it's been so wet, mm-hmm. but there's been concern over the years that you got to be careful about how many wells you allow for irrigation, because that can just affect the quantity of water as well as the quality. And again, is that an accurate description of the concerns?
Yes, and I think that's kind of where the groundwater management area, the more recent discussion around the EAW for irrigation withdrawals, because it was partly just a response to the sudden increase in large numbers of irrigation permits, and the DNR said, whoa, we need to take a look at that because that's such a big increase that we want to understand, you know, whether we have the water to support that. And it's happening in the context of trying to understand statewide groundwater budget and doing the monitoring.
Can we expect this wet year, though, to recharge a lot of the groundwater?
Oh, well, certainly that happens in wet years.
Okay.
I'm not enough of a I'm an ecologist, so I'm not enough of a hydrologist to say how long that bump in the water will last us. A lot of it is how long does the system sort of hold on to that water and retain it, and how fast are we trying to get rid of it with drainage and other infrastructure. But we certainly are seeing some volatility in the rain from year to year.
Uh-huh. John?
So. Yeah, I was just going to mention that you, for these pine lands that we're talking about, you sort of have to remember that they are very well drained by the major rivers of the region. Oh. And it's a very porous aquifer. So it's hard to get the water to dome up much. It domes between the interfluves of these streams that developed largely during that mid-Holocene period. Because the water tables went down, that created a steeper gradient between the river, lots of headward erosion, and that's how the stream capture happened at Winnie, when the Mississippi Channel finally settled on going between Cass Lake and Winnie, and not down through Leech Lake and Leech River.
You know, this is something that John and I just learned this year. Another day, but it's a great aside. And Kirsten, you probably are aware of this too, that the Mississippi River once went down through Leech rather than across Winnie, and it is another day for that story. But in other words, John is saying that there's just a lot of drainage, even in a wet year, that doesn't remain in the groundwater, right?
Yes, and we're getting bigger rain events, which means we see more runoff.
I'd like to ask a question, which will probably expose my ignorance, but when you're talking about groundwater, when I think of the surface of a lake, I think of something relatively flat.
Yeah.
And if you go down 30 feet to get to water, if you go over 100 yards or 1,000 yards or 2 miles, and will it be
the same level, you mean?
Will it be at the same level? I mean, is groundwater flat like a lake, or is it flow up and down? I mean,
no.
No, it's up and down?
The short answer is no, it doesn't. Okay.
It's up and down.
So you might dig a well and get water at 50 feet, and then a quarter mile away, I mean, I have to go down 100 or only go down 20? Is that what you mean?
Depends on the substrate. This depends on what you're digging in.
It's complicated.
That's why I brought up, this is sand, it's pretty porous, but there are layers of other things in the sand and things that can perch water. So no, but it is domed, and the DNR has some maps. A lady named Jan Feltasek developed most of those groundwater maps. And this is my ignorance about the region that we're talking about. I don't know about how deep we're talking about, how deep the stuff is, because what I know about is on the surface and how water affects the native vegetation of the area. How deep we're going and how much water is actually stored in those sands is a bit of a mystery, although I do know that that region has some of the deepest amounts of glacial drift and deposits of any in the state. So it's hundreds of feet.
Okay.
But is that a big aquifer? I don't know where they're drawing the water from.
You know, there's these sort of underwater lakes or lenses that are the aquifers, and the irrigation wells can tap into some of the superficial ones as well as the buried aquifers. So it depends on how deep they want to drill and how deep they have to drill to get the volume of water they're looking for at that area. It can be domed or it can be concave, and then that affects like the pressure the water is under and whether the groundwater is flowing into or out of the lake.
Well, Kirsten, before we wrap up here, how threatened would you say the water quality? In other words, we've heard about some wells having too high nitrate levels in parts of the Pineland sands. How concerned are you about the pollution of the water?
Well, the whole central sands region of the Mississippi Headwaters is one where some of the you know, two-thirds of the folks get their water from groundwater, and a lot of those are private wells, some of them older private wells. And recent monitoring studies by the Department of Health have shown that a pretty, you know, large percentage of them in some areas are kind of moving up close to that, edging up to that drinking water standard for nitrate. So it's definitely something that, you know, if you're in an area, it might be worth having your well tested. We still have pretty clean water for the ecosystems in the headwaters, and that's kind of the aim of our work here is, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It's cheaper to keep clean water clean than clean it up after we get to the point where we're starting to see that. And it's such a cumulative, you know, death by a thousand cuts problem that there's not like a magic bullet once you get to that impaired status. And I just saw in the paper last week, I guess, that even parts of the St. Croix River have now been designated impaired, which is very sad. So we want to, you know, we just need to get ahead of it in the headwaters. while we still have good water.
Well, Kirsten Bland, thanks for taking some time to be with us this morning.
Well, thanks. It's really been interesting listening to your other guests.
Freshwater ecologist and planner with the Nature Conservancy, Kirsten Bland, talking with us about some of her work and her concern about water quality and quantity in the Pineland Sands region of North Central Minnesota. John Allmendinger, hope we can pick up related topics with you again on forest ecology and maybe even the Pineland Sands.
That's no problem.
All right.
I want to hear more about the jack pine.
And if you have some thoughts or comments about our discussion this morning, we'd sure like to hear from you. Our talkback number is 218-999-9876. Our email is comments@kaxe.org.